On the meeting of the Special House Committee on Energy to order. Today is Thursday, February 28th, and the time is now 10:15 a.m. So far this morning, we are joined by Representative Carrick, Representative McKay, Representative Wright. Representative Tuck is in Washington today, Washington, D.C. Representative Prox will be here in a little bit. I assume Representative Shragi will be right here this second. Appreciate you coming today. So, all right. I don't see any other legislators in the back area. So I'd like to thank our House Record Secretary, Jordan Wright, and our LIO moderator, Amanda Kraft, for all they do for this committee. Before we begin, I'd like to remind the members of the committee and the people in the audience, silence your cell phones or other personal electronics. I'll do the same myself. And also, if we're going to see a slideshow, which we probably will, if you'll all hold your questions to the end of each slide. And I'd like to direct members to and the testifiers to your comments should go through the chair. Testifiers will identify themselves for the record when speaking. So today we're going to be taking up HB 74, which is actually quite a cool bill for me. I like this. Geothermal resources by request of the governor. With us today are Commissioner Designee John Boyle for the Department of Natural Resources, Deputy Commissioner DNR John Crother, Representative Prox is in the room at 10:17. He has joined us. Leasing Section Manager of DNR, Aaron O'Quinn, and Dr. David LePain, State Geologist and Director of the Division of Geology and Geophysical Surveys. Participating remotely today is the AOGCC Commissioner, Brett Huber. Commissioner Designee John Boyle, since you've already come forward, if you'd put yourself on the record, please, everybody again, if you would pause after each slide so we can ask questions, and feel free to begin.
Yeah, well, good morning, Chair Rauscher and members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be with you this morning. My name is John Boyle. I'm the Commissioner Designee for the Department of Natural Resources, and today, of course, I'm joined by my very capable team who will really lead us through the technical details of our slide presentation. I really just wanted to cap off today's presentation with some high-level remarks, which is first and foremost, you know, Governor Dunleavy is very interested in pursuing an all-of-the-above strategy when it comes to energy for Alaskans. You know, Alaska is a resource-rich state, both in terms of our hydrocarbons, in terms of our minerals, and in terms of the other opportunities which we have to generate power, whether that be through the wind, through the sun, through our tides, through geothermal resources, through hydroelectric. You know, we have myriad resources that the state can really bring to bear with the ultimate goal, of course, of lowering the cost of power for Alaskans, which we know in many of our communities, some on the rail belt and most off, is a major challenge and a major cost that Alaskan families need to bear. And so today, the real impetus behind HB 74 is to modernize, you know, our geothermal exploration program and help bring that into alignment with what we think the needs of the commercial markets are, to really help encourage and promote exploration and hopefully development of the state's geothermal resources. As many of you know from our testimony in other committees, you know, in South Central in particular, we're looking at declining gas production in the Cook Inlet and thinking through some of the implications that that has on the rail belt's, you know, power security. And, you know, as many of you also know, we in the Cook Inlet, we are surrounded by volcanoes. And I think, you know, the hope is that through some more aggressive study and evaluation and exploration that we can, you know, glean a greater understanding of what geothermal resources may be available on a commercial scale that could potentially be a solution to, you know, fulfilling South Central and the rail belt's energy needs for the, you know, far future. And another thing that we're really trying to do in this bill is to parse out commercial applications for geothermal resources versus kind of at home and domestic. You know, we'd love to encourage people to, you know, implement heat pumps and other technology that can be very efficient and effective in terms of lowering energy costs and reliance on the grid in an individual, you know, person's home and or business or things like that. So we really want to parse out kind of the small scale non-commercial uses of geothermal and allow that to develop and flourish and really focus on, you know, creating this framework to allow more commercial applications for exploration and development to take place. So with that, if the committee doesn't have any specific questions for me, I'd be happy to turn it over to Dr. LePayne and Aaron O'Quinn with our Division of Oil and Gas to kind of walk you through the specific elements of the bill.
Sure. Go ahead.
Good morning. This is Aaron O'Quinn. I'm the leasing section manager with the Division of Oil and Gas. I'll just walk you guys through our outline for the presentation today, and then I'll be turning it over to Dr. LePayne to speak to some fundamentals of geothermal systems. But we'll talk through those fundamentals for a bit, just reorient the committee to those systems, and then we'll get into the bill itself. We'll talk to some of the leasing history of geothermal resources in Alaska, and then we'll get into the sectional analysis and some specific details in that sectional analysis, the real substantive stuff to the bill. And then we also have additional information available for the committee in this presentation on some of the geothermal resources in Alaska and some other topics related to the AOGCC's regulations. So with that, I'll turn it over to Dr. LePayne to talk through some of the geothermal systems fundamentals.
Mr. LePayne.
Thank you.
Yourself on record.
Yeah, through the chair, my name is David LePayne. I'm the director of the Department of Natural Resources Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys. We're based in Fairbanks. I have five slides. This will be a very high-level, brief introduction to geothermal energy. It's not meant to get down far into the weeds. All right, so this first slide just shows some of the basic elements that are required for a viable geothermal resource. So first, you need an elevated geothermal gradient. Geothermal gradient is just the increase in temperature as you go from the Earth's surface downward, and that's just due to the natural heat of the planet. So you need an elevated geothermal gradient. You need porosity and permeability, so that fluids, hot fluids, can migrate through the rocks. You need surface access so that you can build your infrastructure to develop the resource. And you need a sufficiently large hydrothermal system. And, of course, you need customers for the energy. So the cartoon on the left, that's just showing a basic, it's a schematic of a basic commercial hydrothermal geothermal electrical generation plant. So what they do is they drill wells down to the geothermal resource, to the reservoir, and they will then release steam up through the well. That steam will go into the plant. It'll drive a turbine. That turbine generates electricity. And then as the steam moves through that cycle to the other end of the plant, it typically condenses to water. And then they re-inject the water down into the reservoir some distance away from the geothermal plant to be reheated and then eventually recycled back through the system. Pause for questions.
Anybody? All right, begin.
Thank you. So this map is just showing the heat flow throughout the entire state. So most of Alaska is thought to have slightly elevated heat flow. The red areas, the hot temperatures, show elevated heat flow. And you go down to the greens, and that's lower heat flow. However, only a very localized number of areas within the state will have all the ingredients necessary so that you can have cost-effective geothermal energy that can be used. I should point out this map is a little bit misleading. It's made from select data points where we have a measurement of heat flow. And so then between those data points, they extrapolate, and that's how they develop this map. And so you have to be careful when you're looking at this map. But what it does convey accurately is, as the statement says in that rectangular block in the upper right, that most of the state is thought to have elevated heat flow. So before we move off this slide, there are two main geothermal systems, I'll say, that we recognize in the state. One is related to granite. These are large granitic intrusive bodies that are at depth. In some places, the granite is actually outcropping at the surface. And these granites were intruded millions and millions of years ago, and they've been gradually cooling through time, but they're still very, very hot. And so we have three areas in the state where we have granite-related geothermal systems. There's one going across the center of the state. It's east-west. It extends at least from Pilgrim Hot Springs on the Seward Peninsula. It goes eastward towards the Canadian border, at least to Circle. Then there's another granite-related system in the southwestern part of the state. It goes at least from Tatlowixik southwest to Ophir. And then the third area is in southeast Alaska, including where we're sitting right now. The other broad system is volcano-related geothermal systems. We're all aware Alaska has over 50 active volcanoes. The Aleutian Islands, that trend extends out into the Aleutian Islands. That's why the islands are there. The volcanoes extend up onshore through the Alaska Peninsula to the northeast and then up the west side of Cook Inlet. And so, obviously, there's elevated geothermal gradient associated with these volcano-related systems, and we have surface expressions as well in the form of thermal springs or hot springs. We also have surface expressions of the granite-related systems as well in the form of hot springs also.
Questions? No? Continue. Sure.
This is just intended to give you an idea of where we need to be to have conventional hydrothermal geothermal resources. It's just a graph. The y-axis shows depth in feet on the left side, depth in kilometers on the right side, and temperature on the x-axis, Fahrenheit on the upper axis, and Celsius or centigrade on the lower axis. You can see Makuchin Volcano is plotted up there in the upper right. It's this measurement is taken from a depth of about 1,800 feet, and the temperature is just shy of 400 degrees. It's about 380 degrees. You also see Chena Hot Springs plotted there. It's much cooler. The temperature is about 160, 170 degrees, and that's at a depth of roughly 800 to 1,000 feet. You see that sort of cone-shaped structure extending down sort of diagonal towards the lower or center bottom. That's essentially showing you sort of the typical geothermal gradients that we see on the Alaska Peninsula. And this is based on drilling data, oil exploration wells that have been drilled going back to the early 1960s. So we know the geothermal gradient very well. In that area. Typical geothermal gradient for the Earth's crust is about 25 degrees C per kilometer. So the point I want to make here, though, is for conventional hydrothermal geothermal resources, you want to be over towards the right of that graph, and shallower is better because that's lower cost to develop. Pause for questions.
Please continue.
Thank you. Okay, this essentially just summarizes generation capacity per unit cost, and this will depend on geologic and economic factors. So as I've been saying, temperature, hotter is better. Flow rate, like I said, you need porous and permeable rocks, or you need naturally fractured rocks. So higher flow rates are better because you need to produce that water and that steam and run it through turbine. Reservoir framework, uniform porosity is better than fractures, but fractures work. And natural recharge is better than artificial recharge. By that, you need water coming into the system to replace the water that you're pumping out of the system to run your turbines. That's what we mean when we say recharge. Depth shallower is less expensive, thus it's better. I will point out here that some of the deeper geothermal wells in the lower 48 are upwards of 2 miles deep. So, you know, 10,400 feet is roughly 2 miles. So, but a lot of them are much shallower than that, on the order of 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 feet deep. Location. It's nice to have the resource close to a population center. Pause for questions.
Anybody have any more questions for Dr. Payne? No?
Okay, this is my last slide. So geothermal heat, where technically and economically accessible, it's an excellent form of sustainable energy. If you manage the reservoir, if you manage the resource correctly, you'll produce indefinitely. Hydrothermal systems are most common. They're the most common form of energy extraction from geothermal heat. We have hydrothermal systems and electrical generation from geothermal power plants in California, Utah, Nevada, and I believe Idaho. And those are all hydrothermal systems, so hot water and steam. Complex geologic parameters are necessary for a viable geothermal resource. To have all of those parameters present at one location is relatively rare. Alaska contains several potential geothermal resources. I outlined the two broad systems, granite-related and volcano-related. There are a number of areas in the state. We have over or close to 100 what we refer to as geothermal sites. These sites are typically springs, thermal springs that are discharging at the surface. We call them hot springs arbitrarily if the temperature is greater than 50 degrees C, warm springs if it's less than 50 degrees C. That cutoff is arbitrary, totally arbitrary. So we have these thermal springs scattered, widely scattered around the state. We have several dozen associated with granite-related systems in southwest Alaska and running east-west across the center central part of the state, as I pointed out a few minutes ago, and a number of hot springs associated with volcanoes down on the Alaska Peninsula and down in the Aleutian Chain. Important is, I think, the last bullet. This space is rapidly evolving. There's new technology being developed, and we fully expect that within the next 5 or 10 years, we'll be able to develop lower temperature geothermal resources and actually generate power from them. So stay tuned. The technology is rapidly evolving. The DOE, the U.S. DOE, is putting a lot of money into this. They have what's called a geothermal technology office, and they're supporting a lot of research at all the national labs in the lower 48, but also a lot of university research as well through competitive, what are called funding opportunities, FOAs. So anyway, I think that's very exciting. Stay tuned. It's developing rapidly. That's, I believe, all I have.
That was very interesting. Representative Carrick has a question.
Thank you. Through the chair, that was a really informative presentation, so thank you for that. And I'm just wondering, I think one of the first slides you mentioned that the water can be re-injected back and then recycled. And is that a process which is sustainable over the long term, as in is the extraction of geothermal energy take place quicker than that sort of regeneration of the resource? Can you go into that a little bit, maybe?
Through the chair, Representative Carrick, it all depends on the details of the specific system that you're producing, but you have to manage the reservoir carefully. And so what I said is correct. They will usually they'll drill a series of wells, and they'll tap the geothermal reservoir at depth. Commonly, you're dealing with steam. And so steam will rise, drive a turbine, generate electricity, and then go into an injection well some distance away. And that some distance is critical because the steam is going to condense and you're going to get water coming out of it, and that water will be injected. And so you want to make sure that the injection rate is low enough so that it doesn't start to decrease the temperature of your reservoir. And so that's one of the reasons why you want to locate your injection well some distance away from where you're actually producing the steam, because you don't want to cool the reservoir. So it all depends on the nature of your system, what that distance has to be. You know, how far away do those injection wells have to be? Most likely would be more than one well. So how far do those wells need to be separated from your producing wells? So those are the details that depend on the actual nature of your specific hydrothermal system that you're developing. But it's a true statement that if the reservoir is managed correctly, and I know there's a lot rolled into that correctly statement, this resource could be produced indefinitely.
Representative Kerr, follow up.
And what's the lifespan on these wells? I suppose it depends on the reservoir as well, but in general, are they, is the infrastructure viable for 50 years, 100 years? You know, what's sort of the average lifespan of a well?
Through the chair, Representative Carrick, I can't speak to the lifespan of the wells. I know that the turbines typically have a 30 to 40 year lifespan. That's the piece of equipment that's actually spinning and generating the electricity. Those typically, I've seen estimates of 30 year lifespans is pretty typical. The well lifespans, I can't speak to those. I think that might be a question that would be better addressed by AOGCC.
Okay.
Representative?
Yep.
You good? Representative Brock.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair. Of course, the most successful geothermal project in Alaska so far is Chena Hot Springs. There's a couple others in the area, smaller, don't know about them, in Manly, up the Elliott. And then, it's called Chena Power, I think, is working on a project out Dutch Harbor, I believe it is.
Makushin, yes.
Is the state involved with any of that research that they have recovered on those specific, well, I guess the biggest one, I guess, would be Dutch Harbor.
Through the chair, Representative Prax, I'm not sure if the state has been involved in those. To my knowledge, they have not. I don't know if one of my colleagues has information that I don't have.
This is Aaron O'Quinn with the Division of Oil and Gas. The Dutch Harbor project is on Native Corporation lands, and so the state hasn't been involved in any sort of permitting process for state lands, and I don't believe the AOGCC has a well permit for that well. And I know Commissioner Huber with the AOGCC is on the line, and maybe he can speak to that and confirm.
He's on the line, but wasn't listening.
So, Mr. Chairman, I am on the line and was listening. I just wanted to make sure that it was the chair's will for me to participate.
Yes.
So, Mr. Chairman, as far as anticipated well life discussion questions that Representative Carrick had, that depends on how the well is serviced, what the individual circumstances of the well, but it wouldn't be uncommon to have a geothermal well producing for well into the multiple decades. It's a possibility that you'd have to do some workovers, you'd have to do some, come back and do some upgrading or retrofitting of the well, but you could keep that well producing for quite some time. If the well did get to the condition where it was not in good shape to produce anymore, it would also be common to drill a subsequent well in the same vicinity on the same geothermal resource. So I can't give you an exact, but I would say, certainly many decades of service.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I just want to say that there is Haley Payne is also online from Anchorage, Deputy Director, Division of Oil and Gas, Department of Natural Resources, Haley Payne. And Representative Prox, you have a follow-up?
Moving forward then, for purposes of this bill, getting the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission involved with it, would would there be any effort to work with these two existing companies to get the information? Because that makes Chena Hot Springs, for instance, is generating electricity off of a very low temperature or relatively low temperature resource. And would the state become more involved in with what's already going on? Or is that beyond the scope of this bill?
Yeah, Representative Prax, through the chair, this is John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. I think we, under this bill, private landowners would continue to manage their lands. Those projects that we've seen, both the longstanding projects at Chena and the exciting project at Makushan, we have on this slide 6 here, we see the Makushan well up in that upper right corner. As Dr. LePain mentioned, it's a shallow well with a high temperature, so that's a very indicative at a very conceptual level of a very promising project. We would, of course, want successful developers on private lands, that information and lessons to be carried over and understood as best as we can so that our resources are similarly valued and developed. But the intent is really for the right to access state lands to be more favorable and on more market expected commercial terms so that we could see potentially projects on state lands while projects on private lands continue subject to the private landowner's wishes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Precht, from the AOGC's perspective, we would not get more involved in geothermal regulation. In fact, this bill provides us the opportunity to, with our broad authority on regulating geothermal, the ability to not regulate or not participate in projects that are determined to be small-scale, industrial, non-commercial, et cetera. So it wouldn't have any impact on Chena Hot Springs' current operation with AOGCC. A Makushan well would likely need to go through a drilling permit through AOGCC, regardless of this bill is in place or not in place, dependent on the determination of what small-scale or larger-scale industrial is.
Follow-up, Representative.
Makushan, are we referring to that project in Dutch Harbor, or is there some other?
That's through the chair, Representative Prax, yes, that's the project in Dutch Harbor. It's, 8 or 10 miles outside of Dutch Harbor, but it's Makushan Volcano, mm-hmm. and that's a partnership between Unalaska Corporation, Chena Power, Bernie Carl, and I believe Ormat has now entered the equation. They're an international geothermal resource development corporation with a lot of experience. If I could add, Makushan is on private land. Chena Hot Springs is private land. I don't know the situation at Akutan Volcano. I believe Pilgrim Hot Springs, if I'm not mistaken, is also private land. So I mentioned just shy of 100 thermal sites throughout the state. I can count on these fingers the geothermal sites that we have a fair amount of information for. Makushan, Akutan, Spur, Pilgrim Hot Springs, and Chena Hot Springs. Mm-hmm. All those other sites, we know that we have, at most of them, we have either warm springs or hot springs, but we don't know much else about them. So the potential out there we think is enormous, but we don't know that much about it. And so that brings me, and I don't want to get ahead of myself, Aaron will probably deal with this. There's a fiscal note here, and that fiscal note is intended to restart the State Geological Survey's geothermal program. And the reason we want to restart it is exactly what I just said. There are 95 thermal sites out there that we don't know anything about other than we have surface temperature. In some cases, we know a flow rate. Mm-hmm. And that's it. We'd like to change that.
And that was Dr. David LePain speaking.
Sorry about that, Chair.
From the Director of State Geology. Okay, so did another follow-up?
No, I think probably the thing to do is wait so we stay on point for this particular bill.
All right. Thank you very much. So, gentlemen, I want to continue with your slides, if that's mm-hmm. okay with everybody. No more questions? Appreciate it. Please continue. Put your name on the record, and you have the floor.
Thank you, Chair Rauscher. Again, this is Aaron O'Quinn with the Division of Oil and Gas. So we're going to get into the specifics of HB 74 now. You know, Alaska has been leasing geothermal resources since the early 80s. After we've gone through our last round of leasing, we determined that it was time to kind of modernize our statute to come up to speed with the current economic climate in the geothermal industry and the needs of the customers that are looking to do exploration. As Commissioner or Deputy Commissioner Crowther mentioned, you know, we're looking, or Commissioner Boyle mentioned, you know, we're looking at a kind of all of the above approach to energy, and this is one way that we can help promote affordable renewable energy, especially in rural communities that are near these geothermal resources. As I said, we really want to align our geothermal licensing program with the industry as it exists today. We want to provide more time for the company to identify and prove a resource. You know, we have short exploration seasons, we have long distances, and expensive exploration programs that need to take place. And so we want to ensure that those folks have enough time to do that exploration. Instead of exploring and having to find a commercial resource, we're going to base their ability to receive those longer term leases to continue that exploration and eventually move into a production phase. We're going to base that on fulfilling a work commitment. We're going to expand the acreage. As Dr. LePain said, sometimes you need to put your injection well farther away from your production well for resource management purposes. There's a number of reasons why we might need more acreage. Some of these resources, you have to explore a larger area in order to find them. And so we're proposing to double that acreage to 100,000 acres. And then we're proposing to remove an economic provision from the statute that kind of gives had previously given the state the ability to renegotiate the royalty provision after 20 years. We're seeing these projects, as was mentioned, some of the infrastructure lifespans are very long, 30 years or more. The wells can be longer. And so some of the financing vehicles for those projects are over those similar time spans. And that 20-year time span that currently exists in statute was proving to be unworkable for some of our industry. And then we're just going to kind of clean up some of our definitions to bring them up to speed with how the industry sees them today. Our definitions of geothermal resources, and then we're going to eliminate domestic, non-commercial, and small-scale industrial uses from our licensing and leasing program in order to facilitate those personal uses that can help diversify the energy portfolio, you know, on the individual level, as was previously mentioned.
Any questions? Continue, sir.
So just to kind of revisit Alaska's geothermal history, our first geothermal lease sale was in 1983, May of 1983. So this May, that'll be 40 years ago. We've had some subsequent leasing activity in the Mount Spur region since then, including in 2008, where a well was drilled that failed to find a geothermal resource. We've offered Augustine Island tracts in 2013, but no work was ever conducted out there. And then just recently, in 2021, we issued two exploration permits on the flanks of Mount Spur, and then one prospecting permit in 2022 at Augustine Island. So those are existing permits that we have that are subject to that two-year period. And we're really finding that it's difficult to get that exploration work done in that short time period because of the remote nature, and because of the expenses, the capital raising requirements, that sort of thing.
Anybody? Please continue.
Okay, so just to kind of walk through, you know, our current process versus what we're looking to change to, first thing, if we receive a proposal, we'll solicit competing proposals for that. If we get competing proposals, we'll have an auction. If not, we'll typically issue the exploration permit to the individual who applied for it, as long as they meet some qualifications, of course. And what, as I mentioned, the current permitting program offers 2 years of expiration time and then the requirement that a resource be discovered before a lease is issued. The bill replaces that 2 year period with a 5 year exploration license, which is modeled after the way we do our oil and gas exploration licensing program. And again, we're no longer going to require the discovery of a resource to issue that lease. You know, we don't require the discovery of a resource to issue an oil and gas lease in our oil and gas exploration program. We require the meeting of a work commitment. So we want to qualify the individuals by having them do some work out there, spend some money, but we're not actually requiring a discovery, which then allows that group to acquire a lease, which comes with a 10-year period, and then they can really have a nice long runway to raise funds, to do additional exploration, to drill more wells, both production and test wells, and then eventually bring that project into operation, into production, which would preserve that lease, you know, until it stopped producing, essentially.
Representative Prox has a question.
Thank you, through the chair. This bill moves in the right direction, replacing 2 year permits with 5 year leases for exploration. Is 5 years long enough? As long as we're changing something, should we be considering a longer period of time?
Through the chair, Representative Prax, I think we've spoken to our
name on the record again.
Oh, I'm sorry. This is Aaron O'Quinn with the division. We've kind of developed this based, looked at the industry and based this on, you know, a balance of not wanting individuals to be able to warehouse acreage for long periods of time. So, you know, this 5 year period is merely a period to meet a work commitment. So they just need that's expressed in a dollar amount. Mm-hmm. And then after that period, if they meet that work commitment, they get a 10 year lease. So this is an exploration license, 5 years, spend some money, get some work done, and then you get 10 years to continue that work. So it's really a much longer period if they meet that initial threshold of exploration work.
Okay. Thank you.
Any more questions? Please continue.
Well, this next slide just kind of walks through our sectional summary. I won't spend too much time on it, but it's mostly for reference. We'll get into the specifics of that next. So beginning with Section 1, this grants the AOGCC the authority to possibly seek Class 5 well primacy. Class 5 wells are underground injection wells that have myriad purposes, one of which is is geothermal injection. And so, you know, this basically gives them the authority to work with the EPA to receive that direct regulatory authority, but only in the geothermal context. You know, we're not seeing that the EPA is willing to peel off geothermal wells specifically in the Class 5 context at this time, but this would permit them in the future to seek that primacy. And, you know, the reason they might want to do that is because, you know, dealing with a federal agency versus dealing with a state agency for receiving a permit, it's often a night and day difference. You know, the state agencies are quicker. They have more local expertise than the federal agency may have. And, you know, this helps the project proponent by reducing their costs and timelines. And the AOGCC is very experienced working with these EPA underground injection control programs. They have Class 2 primacy currently, which is the oil and gas context, the injection wells for oil and gas. And they have a lot of experience with that already. And I know we do have the commission online for any questions specific to the AOGCC portions of this bill, of which this is. So that's about all I have for the Class 5 primacy, unless Commissioner Huber has something to add through the chair.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. O'Quinn represented the well in the testimony. If you have any questions, I'm happy to address those.
Any questions? Representative Shragi has a question.
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. So on the class 5 wells, is it? Can you define better for me what all is included under class 5 wells, and are there any limitations on depth or otherwise that you could highlight for me?
So thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Shragi. Class 5 wells actually take in 32 subcategories. One of those subcategories is geothermal. So what we're asking for is just permission to seek primacy on the geothermal wells. And then when you take primacy, Mr. Chairman, Representative Shragi, it doesn't change the rules by which the wells are permitted. It just gives the state authority to permit to those EPA rules and then be more responsive, as was suggested by Mr. O'Quinn. But there are not specific depth requirements and those kind of things. Those are left up to the agency. They come in on a permit to drill application. Those permits to drill for oil and gas, and would be the same for geothermal, usually turn around in between 10 days and 2 weeks. So we set depths, we set pressures, we set those kind of things in cooperation with the entity seeking the permit to match the specific circumstances of the well and the environment in which the well is located.
Follow up, if I may?
Follow up.
Yeah, through the chair. And so for the small-scale users that we're trying to, somewhat deregulate or ease the process for, would they still be required to go through that and get that permit to drill for geothermal use if they're a small-scale or low-depth user?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Shragi, this bill actually allows us the opportunity to exempt them from the AOGCC. So they would not. However, I would say that there's one other circumstance that we participate in the geothermal that has an impact, and that is the Commission has twice now selected areas in the state that they put guidelines around the development of. One was Pilgrim Hot Springs. I believe that was 1979, and because the water temperature was hot and as shallow as it was, we just required that anything be done in that area come through AGCC. Another one was done in about 2010. It was a shallow gas issue on the Kenai Peninsula, and we designated some grounds there where we know that there's a high instance of shallow gas located in the area that any well under 500 feet would have to come through the AGCC. So it's potential that we could take smaller scale projects within our purview if we believe it's important to protect the hydrocarbons in the area, to prevent waste, to prevent public safety, to protect correlative rights, or to protect groundwater.
Thank you. One last follow-up, if I may.
Representative Shragi.
So thank you. This is very helpful in understanding this a little bit better. And have we ever, for one of these shallower geothermal drill permits, have we ever rejected one of those? And do you see there being any risk in modifying this process to where, as a default, these small-scale private users would really be with outside of oversight or review by AOGC?
Commissioner Huber.
I'm going to have to do some research, Representative Shragi, Mr. Chairman, on whether we've ever rejected geothermal. I'm not aware of that, but I'd like to get back to the committee on that question if I could, please. And then the second one is, I don't believe it creates a hazardous situation because, again, we have the authority even on the things that are removed from jurisdiction of this bill. If it crosses over into a health, safety, or a hydrocarbon zone, we have existing authority under Title 31 authority to regulate those instances.
I'm sorry. One more follow-up. I'm sorry, Chair.
Go ahead.
Thank you for your indulgence. I guess my only concern is, how would we find out if there was a geothermal well that was beginning to be drilled and it was a safety risk or posed some other risk? How would we find out about that as a state or as a commission? Wouldn't our only way of finding out about that be kind of after the fact, once the damage has been done? And I think that maybe is part of my concern here, is that we're taking a, default, you're exempted and not under our oversight position, as opposed to them coming to us and us, positively affirming that we don't see a risk here and this is fine. I'm just trying to work through that concern for myself.
Commissioner Huber.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Shragi, you raise a good point. The situation is this, however, there's many water wells drilled around the state. that are shallower depth producing water. That's how we see these light industrials, the same kind of thing as those water well circumstances, right? Where it's a home, you have an opportunity to do a heat pump system, you have that kind of thing. We can't characterize every one of those instances without data and without things coming forward, and it would just make it nearly impossible to get a well drilled for water or to be able to do this kind of small scale geothermal. So we believe that we're regulating the point where it makes the most sense under this bill. We have a pass on things that don't, but still the ability to reach into them if they're a problem area, if they undergo a problem. But I just don't think it's feasible to look at the AFGCC, looking at everything that goes in the ground. So I think this legislation strikes a balance there, sir.
Thank you, Joe Rauscher. You've been very kind to me.
And for those listening, in the last round of answers were given by Brett Huber, Commissioner, Alaska Oil and Gas Commission, Conservation Council. Go ahead.
I'm sorry about that, Mr. Chairman. I'll do a better job identifying myself.
Pardon me?
Thank you. Through the chair, that last answer actually raised a question for me because you just mentioned, Commissioner Huber, that the geothermal wells that we're talking about here have the same amount of risk essentially overall as water well drilling. I'm just curious, when you say the depth is sometimes shallower or approximately the same, do you know what the average depth of a water well is versus the average depth of one of these geothermal wells?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carrick, for the record, Brett Huber, Chair of the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. I can tell you that just from personal experience, I know water well depth might range from 500 feet and up, but that's not something that we track or I can give you specific data from the commission.
Representative, follow up?
Thank you. Yes, just a follow up really briefly. I think it would be helpful to understand, I guess, some of the maybe comparisons between those two, since we are talking about these small scale, if the risk is really approximately the same or less than drilling water wells, I guess I want to know a little bit more about comparing those two types of systems and just helping make the case for sort of the safety aspect of these small-scale geothermal wells as well.
Representative Carrick, through the chair, if I may just speak to that very briefly, Chair. So this is John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. Just to provide context, and what we're talking about for purposes of our legislation is primarily deeper wells for commercial purposes, essentially a large geothermal project. In the legislation, we also making the distinction that Alaskans, small businesses may do geothermal prospects at shallow depths for their own purposes, non-commercial in the sense that they're not trying to produce and sell electricity into the broader electricity market. And so making a distinction that those projects have a very different profile, both from a land use, well complexity, and that they're, those kind of very shallow geothermal wells for individual use essentially are more akin to a water well. But these commercial wells, for a large project with an exploration license, would require AOGCC review as a more complex, just at a high level, that's a distinction throughout our legislation.
Representative Carrick?
Yes, thank you. Just really quick through the chair. This legislation is kind of doing both, though. We're talking about the large-scale commercial wells, but we're also exempting these small, and we're separating out the small scale, non-commercial as well. Am I correct on that?
Representative Carrick, through the chair, again, John Crowther, and I don't want to speak for AOGCC, and Aaron O'Quinn may be able to speak a little bit more detail, but there's some scope of what we're trying to do through our legislation is clarify and confirm that those exemptions, both for shallow wells and for just the right of general land use, to more definitively provide those for residential users. I think it's fair to say that there's some level of that today. The exact line drawn by the legislation vis-a-vis the AOGCC authority, Commissioner Huber may be able to speak to.
Commissioner? Do you have a response?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I agree with Deputy Commissioner Crowther and would say that what's happening currently with these small-scale projects, if they exist, are not under the regulation of the committee. I think what this legislation does is just draws out and calls to the public kind of the clear line of who does and does not need to participate through this more exhaustive process for larger projects. It doesn't change what we regulate currently.
Is that enough? You good here? Before I get to Representative Prox, I was just wondering, for the record, can somebody just let us understand how this may or may not affect native land? Since we've heard about private land, we've heard about state land, I just want to know how it intertwines with native land.
Chair Rauscher, this is Aaron O'Quinn from the Division of Oil and Gas. So the state of Alaska, as far as the Department of Natural Resources is concerned, in the leasing context, we license and lease state lands only. Lands owned by Alaska Native corporations are, for all intents and purposes, private lands and held by those corporations. And they are subject to the police powers of the state for safety purposes. And that's where Commissioner Huber's agency would come into play to regulate the drilling of those wells when they fall into a jurisdictional category. When they are of these commercial industrial uses and not the smaller scale uses that we're proposing to exempt here specifically. So Alaska Native Corporation lands are private lands, but they are subject to the requirement of having a drilling permit, just as they are in the oil and gas context.
I appreciate it very much. Thank you. Representative Prox, you had a question.
Thank you. Through the chair. I think kind of to follow up on Representative Carrick's concerns, for those of us that are not immersed in the details of geothermal or, for that matter, oil and gas, does the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission somewhat duplicate what the permitting responsibilities of the Department of Environmental Conservation, or do you interface with the Department of Environmental Conservation at all?
Commissioner, you are.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Prox again, Brett Huber with AOGCC. So, Representative Prox, as I understand it, can you give me your question one more time, please?
Does the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission perform some of the environmental assessment functions of the DEC, or is that requirement covered in some other statute that brings the DEC into the equation?
So the DEC has a role to play from the environmental regulatory side with, for example, sea plans, right? How do you handle a plan if you have a problem with the well or in that area? AOGCC is really permitting the well itself, working through that process, and then works with DEC on those issues, and DEC has some of their own environmental issues that they regulated. We do not.
Representative, follow up?
Yes, just to confirm then, the Department of Environmental Conservation would be involved in the exploration leasing process, permitting process?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Prox, the leasing and permitting process is all the Department of Natural Resources. We are merely involved when we get to a permit to drill or pull a unit together or unit plans on state land only.
Follow up.
Representative?
If I could use an example, and I'm not entirely immersed in geothermal exploration. An exploratory permit is issued by the DEC, I mean by the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Prox, that permit is actually issued by the Department of Natural Resources.
Okay, but at any rate, a lease is issued. if somebody goes out and drills a hole, hits high pressure steam, whatever, loses control of the well, you'd have somewhat the you could potentially have some environmental impact, a bunch of hot water, hot steam from containing who knows what for chemicals could go into a river somewhere. Is that taken? I think the big concern will be, is that possibility taken into consideration, and is that scrutinized well enough before the lease is issued?
Again, Mr. Chairman, Representative Brox, the leasing portion would be a part of the Department of Natural Resources. So we wouldn't explore well control and those type of issues that you talked about until they came to the AOGCC with a permit to drill. And then, yes, we would ask the permit to drill. It's a very exhaustive process. What are you going to drill? How are you going to drill it? What equipment are you going to use? When are you going to do it? What are your tests, et cetera? They engineer all of that, bring it to us. And our regulatory staff takes a look at that engineering, has an iterative process with the permittee if necessary, and comes with a plan by which the well production is conducted. Any deviation from that permit to drill requires a sundry application with us where they say, hey, we thought we were going to do this, but now what we've encountered, we need to do that. We would then review that permit and turn that around if it's a rush immediately or within just a couple of days. So we are working with the driller as they go through this process. Now, should something happen, as you suggest, and there be some kind of catastrophic loss of well control, then that would go through the process by which we would conduct an investigation, understand if there is a violation, what that violation is, what an appropriate mitigating factor and penalties are from that process. So we have the ability to do that, but we really kick in at AOGCC when you're ready to put a hole in the ground.
Okay, and that's just follow up. And that is very similar to what's already occurring for oil and gas drilling. Is that correct?
Exact,
Commissioner.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Prox, again, Brett with AOGCC, you're exactly right, yes.
Okay, thank you. That helps clarify this in my mind.
And just for those who are listening, and I know he did identify himself at the end there, Brett Hubert was answering all his questions, Commissioner, Alaska Oil and Gas Commission, Conservation Commission. So any more questions? Thank you. Go ahead. Please continue with your slideshow.
Chair Rauscher, this is Aaron O'Quinn with the Division of Oil and Gas again. We've moved on to slide 16 just for everyone's reference in the room and following along. So we're just going to kind of combine some of these sections and move through them and get into the substance of the bill here. So we have some cleanup language in sections 2, 10, and 15, which kind of eliminates some duplicate language in Title 41 and Title 31 regarding geothermal units. Those are generally under the purview of the Department of Natural Resources. And so we've cleaned up language in the bill to account for that.
Continue, sir.
So moving on, sections 3 through 6, we're replacing the word permit with license. And so this brings the exploration program in line with our oil and gas statutes where we have exploration licenses. We generally consider permits to be surface in the Department of Natural Resources, permits are surface authorizations. That's how that's evolved over time. And so we're just trying to kind of make everything consistent here. And then kind of a key provision here is Section 17, which allows the conversion of these existing permits, specifically the ones that have been issued to a few different companies at Mount Spur and Augustine Island. We've developed a pathway for those entities to participate in this exploration licensing program.
Any more questions? Continue, sir.
So Section 3, we've added new language, and this is something that we've talked about quite extensively already in this committee meeting, to exempt non-commercial, domestic, and small-scale industrial uses from requiring an authorization with the Department of Natural Resources. We want to encourage this non-commercial use, and specifically residential and really small-scale commercial uses. And I have a slide. The next slide will kind of cover those briefly.
Continue.
So this we have two cartoons here, one of which is a repeat from Dr. LePain's slides. But we on the left here we have a large scale industrial use, and on the right we have some just demonstrations of a way a small scale geothermal resource could be utilized. There's a few different models, but as you can see, we're less than a few hundred feet. We're just looking for that thermal gradient in the subsurface in order to develop a heat exchange that can drive a heat pump or something like that. So these are, usually loop systems. You're not, taking water out, putting water in. It's usually like a closed loop or something like that. And they're shallow. That's the takeaway here. And we just don't feel that it's appropriate for the state to be, authorizing an exploration licensing program for every single home in South Anchorage or whatever. Those types of uses, we want to encourage energy efficiency on a residential basis. We want to encourage, this sort of technological development in our cold climate. And so this is a way we can do that by stepping out of the way.
Any questions? Please continue.
Section 3 also removes preferential rights from our statute. In the current law, there's a preferential right of the surface owner to the subsurface for geothermal. The surface owner is not typically a geothermal operator. This would still allow them to utilize the geothermal resource through our non-commercial exemption, but it wouldn't give them this preferential right to receive a geothermal exploration permit or license. Permits are in the current statute. And so we feel that that's an important elimination of a relic of the past, these preferential rights that don't really make much sense given the way the industry is developed. The surface and subsurface use conflicts that can exist are covered in existing statute. Whenever the state is the mineral owner and there's a separate private surface owner, there is a method for dealing with that in the current statute. It requires the surface owner and the subsurface owner to reach an agreement. If they don't reach an agreement, the DNR can step in to deal with that. But we're not really seeing that ever take place. Specifically in the oil and gas context, out at Mount Spur and Augustine Island, the state owns both the surface and the subsurface. So these don't really come into play in a lot of places. But in the event that there is a surface owner in an area where geothermal exploration is taking place, that surface owner is not typically a geothermal operator. They don't have the subsurface expertise. They don't have the geothermal expertise. So they really should not have this preferential right to that subsurface. And then just to kind of punctuate some of the permitting questions that Representative Prax had, the licensing process is a license to the subsurface only. If the operator is going to conduct surface operations, they have to go to the required agencies to get those permits. If it's drilling a well, they go to the AOGCC. If it's building a road, they're going to come to the Division of Oil and Gas to build that road on that subsurface to get out there, or on that surface to get out there. If they need to emit something from a power, a generator that they have out on the site to run equipment, then they have to get an air permit from the DEC. So they're still subject to the same permitting requirements that exist in the current environmental laws. We're not expanding those or reducing those except for that exemption for non-commercial uses. So they are still subject to that same permitting regime that we require in the current statutes.
Please continue. We have 14 more slides, by the way.
Moving on to slide 21, sections 4 and 7. Again, we're changing from 2 to 5 years. We're allowing that conversion completing that work commitment that's expressed in a dollar figure with annual kind of performance milestones that have to be reported to the Division of Oil and Gas. And then And then these leases will have a term of 10 years with an opportunity for an additional 5-year extension. And we're removing that royalty adjustment at that 20-year period to allow industry to kind of have that more long-term planning with their project financing and economic modeling. That was kind of a wild card in the statute for them.
Please continue.
Moving on, slide 22, section 6. We're expanding the acreage limit from 51,200 acres to 100,000 acres for reasons that we previously cited, but namely just they need more acreage to explore. And then typically, you know, they'll prove their resource and that acreage footprint once they're producing will be reduced to only the acreage that is causing that geothermal system to produce. And then we're changing the rental fees that are currently statutory. We're going to allow those to be established through a public regulatory process, and that will allow us to be responsive to changes in the industry, to bump them up if the competition warrants, or move them down if it doesn't. But it allows us to kind of follow those markets and set those fees.
Please continue.
Section 8 adds three subsections to our geothermal statutes, which basically allows us to unitize geothermal resources much the same way that we unitize our oil and gas resources, essentially, to kind of make common economic terms across that unit and just bring everything together to as one property right, essentially. So sections 9 and 14 on slide 24, we're modifying the definition of geothermal resources to kind of fit the technology that exists. And so we're removing temperature restrictions. We're removing, all sorts of things from the definition in order to allow us to define geothermal resources based on, you know, the way an operator wants to use a state resource. If they're using it for a geothermal resource, or geothermal purpose, then it basically becomes a geothermal resource.
And Representative McKay has a question.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. O'Quinn, I think it's probably important to just make sure for the public's benefit that because this is a mineral, the state revenues to the state from this activity would be subject to the permanent fund distributions as with oil and gas. Is that correct?
Representative McKay, through the chair, believe that's correct. The development of mineral resources have a statutory and constitutional deposit to the permanent fund, so these resources would be eligible for that as well.
Okay, thank you.
Representative, I was just wondering, how does that if you're going to add money to the PF, I mean, where does it come from in these instances? Can you give us an understanding of how the money would come involved toward the state through this exploration process and the use of geothermal energy? If you could just give us an example of how that happens.
Yeah, Chair Rauscher, very, very briefly, this is John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner. So an exploration license, the intent is for exploration to occur, but there's still a fee, perhaps an initial fee or a per acre rental fee associated with it, moderate because we want to encourage this activity. But, you know, then if that moves into a lease, similarly, the rentals accrue under the lease. And if a project moves to development, the department may set terms for the payment of royalty, essentially, associated with production of energy. And so in some ways very analogous to an oil and gas lease in that there's different kinds of revenue at stages of development.
So if they sell, say this turns a turbine and they're selling electric, do we get some of the proceeds, royalties from that?
Chair Rauscher, again, John Crowther. Essentially, the royalty that we're collecting is based on the resource, which is the energetic heat of the fluids in the Earth's surface. And so that's naturally being used to make electricity. One way to perhaps measure the value of that heat is through the electricity generated. but the value and thus the royalty or a fee assessment is really coming from the heat, the fluid that's produced.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Any more questions from anybody? We have a couple of legislators who have an appointment. They're not bored. They have an appointment. They stated it very early on to me, so I appreciate the fact that they were able to stay as long as they could. Representative Prox, you had a question?
Yes, through the chair, I guess same subject. Whatever value could result in a royalty to the state, that would be negotiated rather than set in statute. Is that a fair statement?
Please put yourself on record.
Representative Prox, through the chair, the statute provides that the bill provides that the commissioner may set those rental rates and royalty rates. There's a minimum royalty rate in statute, and then the rental rates can be set by the commissioner via regulation. And so those minimum percentages are in statute. And then the lease that is the subject of the expiration license would have a percentage royalty within that lease that conforms to those minimums that are in the statutes.
That answer was given by Aaron O'Quinn.
Excuse me.
From Leasing Section Manager, Department of Natural Resources. Representative Prox, do you have another follow-up question?
Thank you. Just to clarify, there is something in statute that establishes a royalty for geothermal resources. Is that, am I understanding that correctly?
Representative Prox, is Aaron O'Quinn from the Division of Oil and Gas. That's correct. And we do have Deputy Director Haley Payne on the line through the chair, if I may invoke her expertise in this area.
Yes. Deputy Director of the Division of Oil and Gas, Department of Natural Resources, Haley Payne, are you there?
Yes, good morning. I am here. Thank you, Chair. This is Haley Payne, Deputy Director of the Division of Oil and Gas. If I may add just a little bit of detail to our royalty question that was posed there to the committee through the chair, we do currently have royalty rates set in statute at 1.75% of gross revenue for the first 10 years, and then that escalates to 3.5% after those first 10 years.
Representative Prox, do you have a follow-up?
I guess my concern is that we've set something in statute that is a minimum that might make something uneconomical. And have we thought about that, or do we need to think about giving more latitude to negotiate the royalty rate rather than change a statute? If we're going to change a statute, I guess we should do it now if we need to.
Representative, is that a question, a statement?
Well, yes. Has that been thought through? Is the minimum rate too high to still leave this potential resource attractive to somebody that might want to develop it? Is the current minimum too high? Have we thought about whether the current minimum is too high? There's the proper.
Deputy Director Payne, is that something you'd like to take on?
Yes, thank you. The Chair, Representative Prox, again, for the record, this is Haley Payne, Deputy Director. So I believe that geothermal royalty rates have been before the legislature in the relatively recent past. I would need to get the exact bill in front of me. But those minimum numbers had previously been lowered. They did have a different set of the gross percentage previously. And so we have previously heard this and brought them to these rates. However, that discretionary authority is absolutely within the legislature to invest in DNR. For the purposes of our legislation today, we were merely seeking to take out the ambiguity that happens at that 20-year period because we found it wasn't the rate that was causing the potential for industry. It was actually the ambiguity that was set in statute of the department may change those rates after 20 years. And as we're all aware, the market likes some certainty in terms of the commercial terms. So it wasn't the amount. It was the ambiguity that we had found at this point that had the most need to be adjusted. But we'd be happy to follow up with committee with any previous statutory minimum rates that have been done and when the legislature decided to move forward with a change to those.
With 11 slides to go, Representative, you have a follow-up?
Nope, that is good enough for now, and it would be appreciated if they could apply that to that to us.
Appreciate it very much. So we're back to our slide presentation by Aaron O'Quinn.
Chair Rauscher, just a housekeeping note, we do have many more slides left in the slide deck. We consider much of that supplemental information, and so there's just a few more substantive slides to go.
Thank you very much, but we
do want to cover everything, of course. So moving on to slide 25, section 13, the definition of geothermal fluid. Again, we're removing temperature restrictions. We're including, you know, many different types of fluids to come under this geothermal fluid definition. We're specifically excluding hydrocarbon resources from the definition. And again, this is just to account for the many different technological advances that have occurred, different types of geothermal generating systems that might inject, all sorts of things in closed loop systems or even open loop systems that are artificially there, water that we bring in to inject. So we wanted to just be more inclusive in the definition of geothermal fluid.
Please continue.
So section 12, and this is our final portion of the sectional analysis. This portion modifies the AOGCC's statutory authority, and it allows them to assess penalties for violations of their drilling statutes and regulations in the same manner that they may do so for oil and gas. And this, you know, simple concept, if they're going to be regulating the drilling of geothermal wells, they should be able to have a stick in order to enforce those regulations and ensure that those operations are conducted safely. Having that penalty assessing authority allows them to do so.
Yeah, I just was wondering, that's the penalty section, 41.06.057. I was just wondering, is the dollar amounts there for every one of these that are following underneath there? Do I have that understanding correct?
Chair Rauscher, this is Aaron O'Quinn. I would defer to Commissioner Huber on that matter, but I believe that's correct.
Commissioner Huber, question is the penalties, the dollar amounts, and all of the items that follow. Are they every one of those fall under that restriction, the dollar amount?
Mr. Chairman, again, for the record, Brett Huber from the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. The penalty provisions in the bill are exactly near our penalty provisions in Title 31. It's currently believed that the way that the penalty provisions are drafted in our overall enabling statutes might not carry to geothermal, which is why we've asked for the recitation of them in this bill. But those dollar amounts are correct. We have, of course, a number of mitigating factors by which we consider as we assess any penalty.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Continue with your slides, though, Mr. O'Brien.
Chair Rauscher, Aaron O'Quinn, Division of Oil and Gas.
I'm sorry. I apologize. Thank you. I pronounced your name wrong.
Our kind of final slide for the substantive portion of this presentation is regarding the fiscal note, establishing a new DGGS geologist. And I'll turn it over to Dr. LePain to talk through that program.
For the record, this is David LePain. I'm with the Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys. Aaron stated that there's a fiscal note through the chair. There's a fiscal note associated with this bill, and that fiscal note will essentially fund a geologist four, which is a senior level geologist in our division. And that new geologist, going down the bulleted list there, would coordinate with agencies and industry to publish new geologic data to further development of Alaska's geothermal energy resources. Just historical context, in the 70s and 80s, DGGS had a geothermal research program, applied research program. We have data that's available now from our website the data that is available from our website came from that earlier program. That program was discontinued for some reason before my time. I don't know why. So we want to restart that program, and that's what this fiscal note will allow us to do, collect more data and make those data available. This will also attract federal funds to help us characterize Alaska's geothermal systems and resources. It'll also provide staff to monitor developments in geothermal systems technology. As I said earlier, the technology is rapidly evolving, advancing. And through the efforts to collect more data, the survey will be able to publish data and get the data out and make data available to industry to help spur geothermal exploration and development. This person will also advise DNR and other state agencies on the state's geothermal resources. And they'll support and supply information to explorers and developers of Alaska's geothermal resources. And then they'll also provide advice to the DNR management as well. So in a nutshell, this position will restart DNR's geothermal, applied geothermal research program.
Mr. Brother?
And Chair Rauscher, for the record, John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner, that concludes our the prepared informational slides for today. I would note for the committee's awareness and the public's awareness, we included some supplemental information. That's primarily an overview, as Dr. LePain described, about observed hot springs, warm spring sites around our state as they relate to both the granitic and the volcanic systems. We'd be happy to summarize those for the committee, but if you'd like to conclude, whatever you'd like, Chair.
I have one more question. Granite-related systems, and I know you covered this a little bit before, granite. How does this work for us or against us, this granite? Because I see, I always think of volcanoes as pumice and stuff like that. And so now we're looking for granite, and I'm trying to understand how this is all putting together.
For the record, this is Dave LePain, Director of the Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys. Mr. Chair, I don't think the granite-related systems work against us at all. Volcano-related, granite-related, the volcano-related systems, there is a much greater surface manifestation. It's more obvious that you have an elevated geothermal gradient. You've got volcanoes. And those volcanoes are popping off periodically. Alaska has over 50 active volcanoes. But the granite-related systems, they're not as obvious. The reason we know they're there is because we have these thermal springs, and we know from previous field work in the area that we have these granitic bodies at depth. Some areas the granite is actually exposed. But they're not working against us. We just don't know as much about them. They're not as obvious.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that answered your question, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Does anybody on the committee have another question? Representative Fox has one.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, other things than thermal energy might come up with the steam or water that somebody finds. Some of those things might be valuable. I have no idea. Do we account for that at all, or do we need to account for that?
So, Representative Prox, through the chair, John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner here. If I'm understanding your question, you know, anytime you're developing a subsurface resource, there's a lot down there. You know, you may drill through indications that there's valuable minerals. You may encounter hydrocarbons if you're drilling a very deep well. From a safety perspective, AOGCC requires the understanding of, you know, the strata you're drilling through prior to the drilling commencing so that you identify those risks. If you encounter a gas zone and you're not expecting to, there's behavior in the well that can create risk to safe operations. But in a general sense, a project developer would have to describe and understand what they might encounter and from a safety perspective. Now, were they to encounter or believe they encounter valuable hydrocarbons, they may gain information about the presence of those hydrocarbons, that would relate to the development of them potentially, especially in frontier areas. And in that case, you know, these geothermal licenses are for the production of geothermal. If they, you know, gain better data about an area, either through a surface assessment, seismic, or drilling, and decided, well, gee, we'd also like to pursue hydrocarbons or minerals in this area, they'd have to acquire those separate rights from the department, oil and gas lease, mining claim, other rights, if they wanted to develop those minerals. But certainly those developments could coexist, and the information from one could lead to better understanding of another.
Mm-hmm. I was just not understanding how it works. Sorry, follow up. Yes, through the chair.
I have to say that I have to get out of here pretty soon, and so I'm going to let you have one more follow-up, but then I'm going to close us out. I appreciate everybody here, but I do have to get out of here shortly, so if I can do one more question.
Okay. So from the royalty part, if other valuable things that can be recovered through the stream, the primary purpose was the thermal value, but through that stream something else comes out, does the state miss out on the royalties from that?
Representative Prox, through the chair, again, John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner here. The production of those fluids and gases associated with the geothermal project, I'm not sure if those in and of themselves could contain valuable minerals or commodities. If they did, the developer has a right to utilize the energy under the license, not to collect other commodities. So those rights would have to be secured through an independent means. And a royalty value would have to be recouped by the state.
Okay, that was the point of the question. Thank you very much.
Well, I appreciate you guys, Dr. LePain, Aaron O'Quinn, John Crowther, John Boyle, Haley Payne, and Brett Hubert, both commissioners here. I appreciate everybody's testimony. I like the bill. I appreciate very much the in-depth responses that we got for our questions, also the in-depth presentation that we had. I appreciate those that are online for coming and spending the day with us. So the committee will take this bill up again, HB 74, on Thursday, March 2nd. If you have any amendments, I don't know if anybody has any, but if you have any amendments, please let my staff know by the time we get to the next meeting. We're going to be that lenient about it. We'll also be hearing from Mr. Foos, is that how you pronounce that name? I don't mean to trip over his name. From the Alaska Hydrogen Industries, where he will present the Alaska Green Hydrogen and Geothermal Opportunities. In closing, I do want to thank everybody. Since we have no further business today, I am going to adjourn this meeting at 11:43, I believe. Yep. And thank you.